Thanks for listening to this Moments That Matter podcast. This podcast is a product of Belmont University's Institute for Innovative, Faith-Based Leadership. I'm Dr. John Roebuck, Executive Director of the Institute, and it's my joy to host these weekly podcasts. Each week, you can expect a little insight, a little inspiration, some thoughts on leadership, and maybe even an interview with authors, theologians, and other faith leaders who are making a real difference. For more information about our Institute, please visit our website at belmont.edu/IFBL. This podcast is being recorded, by the way, at the Malloy Studios, part of the Mike Kerb College of Entertainment and Music Business, here on the campus of Belmont University. So let's get to it. You know, I was wondering the other day how we're doing in terms of neighboring each other. I wonder if we've lost the art of being connected in a kind of special way to one another. And if we have lost this art of neighboring, have we ignored Christ's commandment to be better neighbors? Mitch Albom, in a book entitled Have a Little Faith, tells the story of a conversation he had with his elderly rabbi. The rabbi explained this: "When I was growing up in the Bronx, everyone knew everyone. Our apartment building was like family. We watched out for one another. I remember once as a boy, I was so hungry, there was a fruit and vegetable truck parked by our building. I tried to bump up against it so an apple would fall into my hands. That way it wouldn't seem like stealing. But suddenly I heard a voice from above yelling at me in Yiddish, 'Albert, it is forbidden.' I jumped. I thought it was God." Albom asked, "Well, who was it?" The rabbi replied, "It was a lady that lived upstairs. We were part of each other's lives. If someone was about to slip, someone else would always catch him." You know, there was a day when you did know your neighbors, not just by name, but also by need. And because you were neighbors, you helped when the storms of life blew into their homes. Maybe it's time to recapture a biblical view of loving our neighbors. An expert in religious law came to Jesus with a test question: "What do I have to do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus turned the question back on him: "What do you think? How do you read it?" The young lawyer responded, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself." "Exactly," declared Jesus. "Do this and you will live. You will find the life that you're searching for, the life that God blesses, the life that gives blessing in return." The young man should have stopped while he was ahead, but he had to press the point. "And who exactly is my neighbor?" In response, Jesus was about to change everything this young lawyer had ever thought about being a neighbor. In fact, Jesus tells the parable in Luke 10 of the Good Samaritan, an oxymoron to the first century hearer. There was no such thing as a Good Samaritan. Ingrained into the heart of every Jewish man was a hatred and distrust for Samaritans. The Samaritans were Jewish half-breeds. They corrupted the bloodlines and sacred worship practices during the time of the exile. They stayed behind when all the good Jews were taken away. Yet Jesus will set up this Samaritan as the hero of his story, or more specifically, as what a real neighbor should resemble. It was a shocking and mind-blowing story to hear. And it went like this. A Jewish man traveled from Jerusalem to Jericho. It is a notoriously dangerous road. The topography is difficult. The bandits seem to lurk around every corner. And sure enough, he was attacked. He is stripped of his clothing, beaten severely, left to die. Two men, whom the listening audience would expect to help, arrive on the scene. One is a priest and the other is a Levite. But neither stops to help. They fear defilement, maybe physical harm. They don't want to be inconvenienced. They don't want to bother of helping this injured man. The help would take time and effort and energy. Those are things they were not willing to commit. And then Jesus interjects a Samaritan into the story. The New Living Translation calls him a despised Samaritan, revealing what everyone was thinking about him. His response is different. He sees need and he feels compassion. Already acting like a neighbor, he soothes and bandages the wounds. He puts the injured man on his own beast, which inconveniences self. And he pays for the needed care and even offers to do more if needed. So who's the neighbor, Jesus asked. The answer sticks in the throat of the Jewish lawyer. He can't bear to say or even think of the possibility that a Samaritan could be a neighbor, maybe even his neighbor. And so he responds, "The one who showed mercy." And Jesus says, "Then go and do the same." You see in that Samaritan response the characteristics of being a neighbor. He sees need, he feels compassion, he takes on the responsibility at the risk of inconvenience. He follows up with good care. The lawyer has to rethink his definition of a neighbor. Jesus had opened his mind and began to explore some places the lawyer had never been. Who is your neighbor? It's a good question to ask these days. The answer depends on whom you ask. For a first century Jewish man, the answer is a fellow Jew. For most of us, the answer is not terribly different. We tend to express neighborly love and concern for those who look like us and think like us, those who share our values and our religion, our skin tone, our language, maybe even our political affiliations. Jesus opens up the dialogue to say that our perceptions and preconceived ideas may need to change. Our neighbor could and should be anyone. Will Campbell points out the one thing that we all have in common is the earth. We are all neighbors. As Christians, we must learn to train ourselves to think more globally, to live without barriers, without borders, beyond race and language. We should get to the point that we would say, if someone is breathing, then that person is my neighbor. That's the Jesus ethic. And I hope we all get that on some level. But for the sake of our discussion, I want to scale it down a bit. I want to take that global concept of loving neighbors and focus it down to a more local expression. If you were to ask a child this question, "Who is your neighbor?" Working with simple concepts, the child would respond, "Well, my neighbor is the person who lives next door." And Webster agrees. Webster defines neighbor as a person who lives close by, a nearby resident. What if that became the definition of a neighbor for the people of God? How would that look, and how would loving our neighbor transform our communities, our city, and maybe even our world? In Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 through 39, Jesus is asked about which commandments are the greatest, and he offers the same words as those of the young lawyer. "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest command. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself." Well, what if we took that seriously? Not in some nebulous, undefined way, but what would it look like for us to really love our neighbors, the people who live physically close to us? What if Christ intends for us to take that commandment literally? Do we love our next-door neighbors? I read a story this week about former actress Yvette Vickers. She was best known for her role in the movie Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. She died in her early 80s, although no one knows exactly how old she was when she died, because no one knows exactly when she died. According to the Los Angeles coroner's report, she lay dead for the better part of a year before a neighbor noticed cobwebs and yellowing letters in her mailbox. This neighbor reached through a broken window to unlock the door and pushed her way through piles of junk mail and clothing that littered the house. She was found upstairs, space heater still running, computer screen still glowing. When they investigated her death, they discovered that she had become increasingly more connected online with Facebook and social media, but less connected in real life. None of her neighbors had missed her for nearly a year. May God forbid. Should there be a difference in the way that Christians and non-Christians neighbor in community? Was Jesus really onto something? Did he understand that if we change our communities, we can change the world? The problem with loving our neighbors is that the majority of Christians don't even know the names of most of their neighbors. And so maybe it all starts with a willingness to get to know the invisible neighbor that lives close by. You know what I'm describing. You catch a glimpse of that neighbor from time to time. Maybe you offer a wave. You know they exist. The yard gets mowed. There are lights on at night. There are cars in the driveway and garbage cans on trash day. But that's about all you know. What if every person who believes in Jesus actually learned to love his or her neighbor? I think neighboring relationships could make a real difference. Look at what happens, for example, when we don't love those who are close by, when we don't love our physical neighbors. Isolation happens. It's easy to live a lonely life. It's easy to leave the house early, rush home, and zip into the garage. You have neighbors like that. I do too. The garage door opens. They leave. It opens again at the end of the day, and they return. It closes as soon as they get inside. Maybe you've become that kind of person. But when we fail to neighbor each other, isolation happens. Fear also happens. We become wary of folks that we don't know. Whatever is unknown is scary, and it's easy for us to imagine the worst about someone. So we tend to be isolated, we tend to fear, and then we also allow misunderstanding to happen. It's easy to get the wrong idea about others. I read about a neighbor who began to notice some things about a house in his cul-de-sac. The garage door was broken. It remained only half open. A car out front hadn't moved in weeks. The lawn was getting tall. Others began to assume bad things about the neighbor. Some thought the house was abandoned. Others thought that drug dealers must be using the house. And so rumors quickly spread through the neighborhood. Finally, a neighbor knocked on the door. He discovered that the owner, a single woman, was the primary caregiver for her mother who was dying of cancer. Fixing up the house and caring for the lawn was the least of her worries. As soon as that news began to spread, other neighbors jumped in to help. The misunderstanding was soon cleared up. But you can see how it happens. Isolation, fear, misunderstanding. So I wonder if we can make a conscious effort to really know our neighbors. You know, when we insist that we are neighbors with everyone, that makes us neighbors with no one. For it all begins with a name. So here's something I want you to consider for a moment. I want you to think about the 7 or 8 houses that are closest to the place where you live. Think about the house in which God has placed you and your family, and think about your immediate neighbors. Those are the people you should care about. You could probably stand at your front sidewalk and literally throw a rock and hit their house. Don't do that. We want to build relationships, not break windows. But think for a moment if you took out a sheet of paper and you put your house, drew a little drawing of your house in the middle of the sheet of the paper, and then you drew 7 or 8 boxes around your house. So imagine then that those become your neighbors' homes. And I would ask you, could you begin at the top of each box to fill in the names of your neighbors? Then could you write down some relevant information about each family, things that you've picked up along the way? And then in the same box, just under their names, could you also write down any in-depth information that would come through connecting with them at a deeper level? Let me tell you what you're going to discover. Only about 10% of us could actually write down the names of our 8 closest neighbors, only 10%. About 3% of us could write down some relevant information, and less than 1% could write down some in-depth information. What does that say to us? It says we don't know our neighbors. We need to start at the basics. In order to love someone, it actually helps to know their names. And so I want to give you a challenge. I want to challenge you to discover and learn the names of your closest neighbors. Learn about the adults, learn about the kids, learn about the teenagers. Start to make a list. Ask and seek and knock. You may even need to consider having a gathering of some kind to meet your neighbors. And some of you will be reluctant to do that, I know. And some of you already know the names and others don't have a clue, but names are important. Let's talk about motive for a moment. What would be the reason for getting to know your neighbors? Is there an ulterior motive? An ulterior motive is one that is intentionally kept concealed. It's a secret, and it can be manipulative. Your neighbors may well think that there's a hidden agenda if you start to act interested in their lives. So you're going to have to assure them that there is no such motive. You're not trying to sell them something or convince them of anything or win them over to your way of thinking. There is, however, an ultimate motive. An ultimate motive is an eventual point toward which you are moving. It's a longed-for destination. That ultimate motive is to do exactly what Christ has called you to do, to love them in His name with no strings attached. You see, the ultimate motive in what I'm asking you to do is not to share your faith. This is not about an evangelism strategy. The ultimate motive is to demonstrate your faith by simply loving your neighbor. So listen to me carefully. We don't love our neighbors in order to convert them. We love our neighbors because we are converted. Let me say it again. We don't love our neighbors in order to convert them. We love our neighbors because we are converted. We are called to love people, period. We need to cultivate a deep longing to share our lives, our love, and our stories with our neighbors. When we learn to love them, we'll open up all kinds of doors for the Spirit to work. And it won't be out of manipulation that people come to faith. But people may well gain a better understanding of who Jesus is because, as His servants, we're doing exactly what we have been commanded to do. So let me challenge you to start learning the names of your neighbors. Start a conversation. And if someone asks you this week, who is your neighbor? Don't give some grandiose, pious-sounding theological answer. Just give them the names. My neighbors? Well, that's Bill and Jane and Michael and Sue. And so let me challenge you to let the process of loving your neighbor begin this week. I don't have to tell you that we live in a time where people are segregated, alienated from one another. It's time for us as the body of Christ to do better, to live by a higher standard of ethic. So let's learn who they are. Let's love them with the love of Christ. Let's see where those conversations might take us. This has been a Moment That Matters. Thanks for tuning in.